Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, May 28, 2018. The United States proposes UN sanctions on certain South Sudanese individuals. Will it pass?
We welcome any move, any attempt by international community, by the regional community, in order to resolve the conflict in South Sudan. We are not happy about the protracted conflict.
And police in a Ugandan settlement tell South Sudanese refugees crime will not be tolerated in their country.
We are tasked with the primary duty of protecting your life and your properties. On top of that, we have to make sure that the laws of our land is preserved. We preserve the law and order of this land.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Trump administration is following through on its pledge to punish South Sudanese leaders responsible for fueling violence in South Sudan. The U.S. has distributed a draft resolution expected to be tabled at the UN Security Council meeting at the end of this month. The resolution targets several South Sudanese leaders on both sides of the warring parties. The draft resolution will need only 9 yes votes out of the 15 total votes in the Security Council. The measures in the draft proposal includes asset freeze, a travel ban on 6 South Sudanese officials, including Defense Minister Kwal Manyang Juk, Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomero, former Army Chief Paul Malong, Minister of Information Michael McQuay-Lueth, and Deputy Chief of Defense for Logistics Malek Ruben Riak Rengu. The proposed sanctions will also target Kwang Rambang, the rebel-appointed governor of Bias State. South Sudan in Focus obtained a copy of a letter written by Cecilia Adeng, South Sudan Deputy Representative to the United Nations, telling the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Juba to reach out to China and Russia for a possibility of using their veto vote. This program made several attempts to reach the Minister of Cabinet Affairs, Martin Elia Lomero, and Information Minister Michael McQuay for comment. We could not reach Defense Minister Kwal Manyang Juk, who is receiving medical care in Nairobi for unknown illness. An official of South Sudan's SPLM-IO rebel movement says the group welcomes any new sanctions on South Sudan's government officials for their role in the country's ongoing civil war. One of those expected to be sanctioned from the rebel side is General Kwang Rambang Cho. General Oyet Nathaniel Pierno is head of the governing team for the SPLM-IO rebels. He says the sanctions against government officials are long overdue. On the contrary, Pierno said sanctioning General Cho would be double jeopardy because the rebels are fighting in self-defense.
We are very happy about the sanction. It is coming from the UN Security Council. This sanction is long overdue. We have been waiting for it. We have been expecting it. Kwal Manyang has been the defense minister in the government of South Sudan. He has been responsible for planning of war. He has been responsible for policy of the SPLA. To us, the government of South Sudan through SPLA has been targeting civilians, has been waging targeted killings on South Sudanese since 2013. So this sanction is a way of accountability, and we are happy about the sanction.
But the Security Council has also put sanctions on General Kwan Rambang Cho of your side. He is accused of leading an attack in Bio State recently.
We feel that this is a double jeopardy because General Kong Rabban has been fighting in self-defense. He has been fighting the onslaught by the government. As you recall, Taban Dengai and the president, they sent the SPLA to Bio State area in an attempt to capture Yuai, in an attempt to capture Akobo. So General Kong Rabang was fighting in self-defense. He has not planned any violation of ceasefire, but he has been fighting, resisting the onslaughts by the government. resisting the fighting which has been planned and orchestrated by the government in this area.
But also the government of South Sudan can argue that it is fighting in self-defense against you, the SPLM-IO, because it is the government of South Sudan and it must defend the country.
Well, we have signed the cessation of hostilities in Addis Ababa in December. We have not left our defensive position to go and attack the government. It is the government that left their position. It is the government that planned attacks from Juba. Taban Dengai left with a huge team from the government of South Sudan, escorted by the regular SPLA to Lao Nuer area, the DA state area. So they left their position. They planned for the attacks, where Kong Rabang has to defend his position.
That's General Oyet Nathaniel Pierno, who heads the governing team of the SPLM-IO rebels. He was speaking to my colleague, James Buddy. The Sentry, an investigative arm of the Enough Project, says sanctions can have a big impact on corrupt individual South Sudanese leaders who have assets overseas, including countries neighboring South Sudan. Joshua White, the director of policy and analysis of the Sentry, says previous sanctions by the United States have prevented some individual corrupt South Sudanese leaders from accessing their assets, including transactions in U.S. dollars.
Sanctions help disincentivize the parties from perpetuating the conflict in order to personally gain or financially gain from the discord that's going on. Our view at the Enough Project and at the Sentry is that those in power continue to engage in mass atrocities and human rights abuses in order to maintain access to the finances and resources of the state.
In a situation like South Sudan, several leaders of the warring parties have been sanctioned before, and nothing happened. For them, life is as usual. Do you still believe sanctions can bear pressure on the leaders of the warring parties to end the violence?
I do. What's critical is that network sanctions be applied. So not just listing one or two individuals, but the individuals that are acting on behalf, the people who are moving money for these persons. We recently saw the United States do this, listing Benjamin Bolmel, a South Sudanese individual, and several of his companies in December. We've seen a change in recent years where the United States is taking a very different approach to sanctions, where they're now not just going after the individuals, but after their holdings and companies as well.
In South Sudan, there are several South Sudanese who hold dual citizenship. For instance, there are people in the government who are both South Sudanese and U.S. citizens, and some of them are even British citizens. In a situation like that, if you impose individual sanctions on such people, which passport are you going to chase them on?
If the United States lists them and sanctions them, they aren't able to do business in dollars. They become pariahs and they lose their access to the international financial system. When someone is both a U.S. citizen and a foreign person, it's sometimes rare for the United States to sanction them, but it is possible. And as a result, if they are overseas, they are not able to engage in U.S. dollar transactions or even hold assets in their own country.
Talking about the United Nations, several attempts to sanction the leaders in South Sudan at the UN Security Council met resistance from countries like China and Russia. Is there still hope that the UN Security Council will impose sanctions on individuals blocking the road to peace in South Sudan?
I think it will be critical for the African members of the United Nations Security Council that are currently holding their rotations. I think their support will be critical and will be key. I think as the situation deteriorates and we don't see any progress with the IGAD talks, I think that there should be and hopefully will be an understanding that the situation is getting worse. I think the African Union has made very clear that they will support pressures for spoilers in the discussions, in the talks. And as a result, hopefully that means that African Union members on the Security Council will now see it to be supportive of additional levers of pressure at the UN.
One example of an instrument of diplomacy is sanctions. Are there other instruments of diplomacy that could be used in the situation of South Sudan where some individuals don't even care whether they are sanctioned or not, and they continue to fuel the war in the country?
What I would say is there's multiple kinds of sanctions. So there's financial sanctions. There are visa sanctions. And just to be clear, I think a lot of these people do care because South Sudan is a highly dollarized economy. I think they like to travel to places like Europe, the United States. They like to have houses in Uganda. They like to have houses in Australia and Kenya. But there's also anti-money laundering. The United States actually did take this action last year. We saw that have a tremendous impact on the willingness of banks to do business with South Sudanese elites and officials in the government, because the United States in that instance warned the international financial community that, especially when it comes to buying houses and engaging in real estate transactions and other similar kinds of transactions overseas, it's incredibly risky to do business with officials of the government of South Sudan. I would just say it's incredibly critical for meaningful sanctions, sanctions that have a bite, to be put into effect as soon as possible for those on both sides of the conflict that are playing a spoiling role. I think that these listings at the UN, if successful, will play a big role in bringing pressure to bear. Some of these individuals, my understanding is, based on who's being considered, are already listed by the United States. I think it's critical that the UN take action now as the situation gets worse by the day.
That's Joshua White, the Director of Policy and Analysis of the Sentry, an investigative arm of the Enough Project. He was speaking with my colleague John Tanza from Washington earlier today. Thousands of inhabitants of Kajo Keji in Yei River State, who were forced to abandon their homes twice in less than a year due to fighting in the area, say they will not join more than hundreds of thousands of other South Sudanese living in refugee settlements in Uganda. They've instead settled near the South Sudan-Uganda border in Kerwa, a sub-county of Yumbe District, where local leaders have given them land for constructing houses and farming. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from Yumbe in Uganda's West Nile region.
Hundreds of South Sudanese refugees, including elderly men, women and children, gathered at Tika 4, an extension of the Rhino settlement, to listen to a team of regional and district police officers talk about their rights and how to live peacefully among themselves and the host community during their stay in Uganda. Tika 4 is the newest addition to the Rhino settlement that hosts some 3,500 refugees. Josephine Anguchia is police superintendent for West Nile Regional Police based in Arua.
The work of police is not only to arrest, not only to follow criminals, but also to educate you. When you're here, you take your time, you study the environment, you study how people behave, you study our laws.
Inspector Cyprian Okwera, the officer in charge of the Yoro Police Post that serves much of the Rhino settlement, describes to the refugees the role of police deployed within the settlement.
We are tasked with the primary duty of protecting your life and your properties. On top of that, we have to make sure that the laws of our land is preserved. We preserve the law and order of this land. We also make sure that at all costs, we should try as much as possible to prevent the occurrence of any crime.
The refugees listen quietly as Officer Maika Avubieng highlights what constitutes a crime under Uganda law and the penalties violators can expect if those crimes are committed.
Should you bring disorder here by fighting, their work is to arrest you and take you for prosecution. Threatening violence, you'll be arrested and taken to court of law. 14 years in prison. You men, you can't rape these girls, you can't rape these women when they are facing firewood. If you're committing crime called rape, you'll be arrested and taken to courts of law. Killing, we call it murder. It is a crime in Uganda.
Florence Oyoma, the Arua District Police Officer in charge of Child and Family Affairs, made it clear to refugees that our office will not tolerate sexual violence in the settlement.
Domestic violence is a crime in Uganda, and I want to tell you today that you people, you are still new arrivals. That's why we said we must come and talk to you, so that tomorrow when the issue comes to OC, OC will push it to your room. OC will push it to the main station. Then it will come to me. Me, I will have no mercy. I will push you to prison.
Harris Omar, a Tika 4 community leader, admits that assault is a somewhat common occurrence among refugees. He says it often starts between children at water points and quickly spreads to their parents and other members of the community.
So from there, children, they can abuse each other. After that, mothers, they come and involve themselves. Even the youth, when they see their relatives fighting, they come for support, for help.
Fatuma Chow, a women leader at the camp, says the refugees need more time to adapt to their new surroundings, but gradually, she says, their habits will change.
They are still new. Now, to change them, need this way, need this way. Today, tomorrow, like this, they will become into one line.
Superintendent Nguchio cautioned the newly arrived South Sudanese about bringing weapons into Uganda, which they could be tempted to use in the act of a crime. Nguchio says all weapons in the country must be surrendered to authorities immediately. She says if that happens, they won't be penalized, but warns if anyone is later found with firearms, they would face the full force of the law. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Apiku in Kampala.
Our thanks to Simon Peter Apiku with the story of what police in a Ugandan settlement are doing to stop the spread of crime. Tune to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a top researcher is working to help contain the Ebola outbreak in the DRC. Those details when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
can you get just as good a university education in your home country as you would abroad?
Yes, I can get a good university, number one. I can give an example in Uganda. We have Makerere University, it's a good university. So if it's a good university, it can give us whatever we can. Best ranked, I think, in Africa.
I believe that the schools out there are better. Maybe because the countries are much more developed and they do a lot of specialization than the schools or institutions we have this week.
Yeah, I think that you can get the base and quality education from your home university or from your country. But basing on other countries' development or level of study, you can go for further specialization, but after you come back to invest in your country.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The World Health Organization has described the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo as sitting on an epidemiological knife edge. As the virus continues to spread, it has been identified in three parts of the country. Meanwhile, Merck, a top drug researcher and manufacturer, hopes that its work is making a difference as the Ebola crisis plays out. Health workers are counting on Merck's Ebola vaccine to help contain the outbreak of the deadly disease. The vaccine is called experimental because it is still in the United States' complicated drug approval process. Beth Ann Coller, executive director of Merck's vaccine's clinical research department, spoke with VOA's Paul Alexander about the painstaking vaccine development process, how the drug works, and why it has to be kept so cold.
How does it feel to see the results of all your time and investment at work?
Well, thanks for that question. We are actually, very pleased to see that the vaccine that we've worked on for several years now being deployed and hopefully making a difference in helping to control this outbreak. So yeah, it's a very exciting, you know, it's obviously something that the whole world is paying attention to, and we're really pleased to hopefully be able to play a role.
Is the vaccine the same as the version that was used at the end of the big West Africa outbreak?
Yes, it's the same vaccine candidate that was tested in the clinical trials, including the trials in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia.
So for a layman like myself, can you explain how it works?
Sure. So the vaccine is a live virus vaccine. It has just one little piece of Ebola virus, the surface protein that coats the surface of Ebola virus, expressed in the backbone of a harmless virus. And so it replicates in the body and induces an immune response, things like antibodies that we believe are protective.
Why does it have to be kept so cold?
So because it is a live virus vaccine, and it was developed very quickly, so there wasn't time to do a lot of formulation, what we call formulation development, something we would typically do in a normal development process that takes many years. We worked very quickly to get this product out there for testing as quickly as possible, so we weren't able to do optimization of the formulation. So we have to keep it ultra cold in order to ensure that it maintains its potency.
Are there hopes that you'll be able to develop a version that won't have this requirement?
Well, that's a great question. That's not so obvious to do because all of the work that was done, all of the clinical work that was done, including the demonstration of efficacy, was done on the existing formulation. So it's a fairly complicated question to answer, actually, and one that we haven't wrestled with yet. Our focus right now is really to make the product available as quickly as possible and to achieve licensure as quickly as possible.
How far along in that process are you?
So we're making good progress. There was, you know, many, many studies that were conducted, 12 or 13 clinical trials, a similar number of preclinical studies, all of the manufacturing efforts. So we're pulling all of that together to support a submission for regulatory approval.
Beth Ann Coller is the Executive Director of Vaccines Clinical Research at Merck Research Laboratories. She spoke with VOA's Paul Alexander from Washington, D.C. Uganda wants to attract more tourists, not just with its natural beauty, but also with its dark history. The Ugandan Ministry of Tourism, Wildlife and Antiquities plans to unveil a war museum showcasing colonial-era wars and more recent conflicts. It will feature a figure that many people in the world know, but whom many Ugandans would rather not remember, the notorious late President Idi Amin Dada. The subject of Idi Amin is causing controversy, and as Halima Athumani reports from Kampala, it reflects Uganda's changing attitudes on its dark past. Halima Athumani reports for VOA from Kampala.
Gifted by nature is a slogan Uganda uses to promote its tourism, especially wildlife, primates, and freshwater lakes. The tourist trade brings in more than $1.3 billion per year. Now, Uganda plans to join countries such as Germany, Cambodia, Japan, and Rwanda as destinations for what is known as dark tourism. A planned war museum will showcase Uganda's long history of conflict. Exhibits will focus on the colonial era, the Lord's Resistance Army War, and President Idi Amin's bloody eight-year rule, when as many as 500,000 people were killed in political or ethnic persecution. The topics are unpleasant, but for Chiwanda Godfrey, Uganda's State Minister for Tourism, they are an opportunity to show that Uganda has moved on.
Can you imagine if you go to some countries, some people still believe that this country is still governed by Amin, and some people still fear our country because of Amin. You cannot be in leadership and you leave that. So we are coming up with a package, what we call dark tourism. We should have a record. What are the massacre memorial sites? How many are they in northern Uganda?
John Sempewa, the Deputy Executive Director of the Uganda Tourism Board, disagrees with Godfrey when it comes to dark tourism. He says Ugandans are not ready to revisit the Idi Amin era.
Which Ugandan is going to put up a museum and say, you guys come here and this is Amin's museum? It's not ready because society is divided. There are people who are still around who don't have good memories of Abin. Now, not only won't they come, they might burn this place down.
The war museum is championed by some army generals in the ruling National Resistance Movement who fought in the Luero Triangle guerrilla war that saw President Yoweri Museveni come to power in 1986. Kaps Fungaru, a legislator from northern Uganda, a region that has borne the brunt of war in Uganda's conflict history, says dark tourism will not help heal the wounds of people who have never obtained justice. He says that if dark tourism is to be encouraged, it should cover all massacres that have happened around the country, including ones involving the ruling party army wing, then known as the National Resistance Army.
You must also make tourists to go to Teso, where the NRA war resulted to massacres of people, for example, in Mukura, where the NRA soldiers roasted people alive in a train wagon. So when you want to take that direction of the dark history of the past, be ready to also carry the cross of NRM.
Uganda tourism officials say they have earmarked a 2-hectare piece of land for construction of the war museum, but no launch date has been set. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Sitaya Los by Eddie Kenzo. Eddie Kenzo with the song Sitaya Los. I'm Ayandeng Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Sichalosi, ndi boss. Sichalosi.